那
we'll call the meeting of the House Agriculture and Rural Development Committee meeting to order April 19, 2006. We do not have a quorum yet, but that's never stopped me before. So we're going to go ahead here. I will move, when we do have a quorum, House File 4041, be recommended, passed, and sent to the Rules Committee. With that being said, what I'm looking at today is approximately, we'll go 40 minutes for the proponents of House File 4041, and then we'll go about 40 minutes for people with concerns, and then we will see if we're ready to act on the bill. Now, our discussion will include more than just House File 4041. This is a bigger issue. It has to do with basically that this bill has to do with saying that we can't charge more than $750 for aquaculture facilities. Currently, that's the maximum that we can charge for agricultural irrigation permits and so forth on water usage. And we will, what my bill would do is say that the most you could do, we would include aquaculture and the same as agricultural irrigation, where it cannot exceed $750 per year. Right now, the way it looks in the case of Spring Valley Ponds, it could be about $7,000 per year. I happen to believe that that's excessive, and I hope that the committee members will agree with me on that. So the motion would be to go to Rules Committee. So we do not have a quorum, yes, we cannot take any official action, but for the record, we will start taking testimony. So if Mr. Bond is, so the schedule will be about 40 minutes, people for the bill. That doesn't mean you have to use that. 40 minutes, folks with concerns. And as I said, the bill, the discussion will be broader than just the water permitting fee. The discussion will also include the state of aquaculture in the state of Minnesota, what's going on, where it's headed, if with the current DNR and the MPCA rulings, if you could even start an aquaculture firm today or farm. We'll say so with that. I'd invite Mr. Bondas down and whoever you'd like to have come with you at this point. Is it Sternberg or welcome to the Ag Committee, Mr. Bondas, and if you could introduce who you have with you there, and then we will go into your presentation, and you have the floor, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. This is Dick Sternberg. He's a former DNR biologist and quite a few years and Rebecca Clutton is working with us on the engineering part of this project.
It's Rebecca Klecko. How do you spell that?
K-L-U-C-K-H-O-H-N.
Okay, thank you.
And there's Tony and I have working with me, Harry Gallagher from
okay. Yeah, if you just all four want to sit down there, and then Mr. Bondas, if you want to, I believe you have a DVD to go through here with us.
Okay, I have a DVD. I want to show you what this thing is like first. Then I got a little bit of a presentation.
The Spring Valley Ponds site, located just outside the village of Spring Valley, Minnesota, has been a registered fish hatchery since the 1940s. But its unique water and surrounding land resources lay generally neglected for many years. That neglect ended when John Bondas took an interest in the property and purchased it in 2002. John is the founder of Bondas Corporation, a tool manufacturing company recognized worldwide for highest quality standards and pioneering inventions. John has been raising fish for the past 40 years, and more than 30 years ago founded the North American Native Fishes Association, a non-profit organization dedicated to the study and protection of both game and non-game fish, and fostering education on environmentally sound use of aquatic resources. Now, well-designed and strategically located aerators and degassers acts as the heart and lungs of Spring Valley Ponds, pumping new life into the system by removing harmful carbon dioxide and supersaturated nitrogen at the same time that they greatly increase the vital oxygen level. Left untreated, the spring water would cause frequent fish kills in over half of the ponds. John assembled a team of a half dozen colleagues who apply more than 100 years of collective experience in hatchery management, pond management, education, and innovative solution development to revive the life-sustaining potential of these ponds. In addition to implementing new aerators, bottom sediment was cleaned and piled into new islands and peninsulas to improve access and enhance natural aesthetics. A layer of sand was added and compacted on the pond beds to help keep the water clean over a longer term. Bottom contours were deliberately retained for a naturally protective and varied fish habitat. The redevelopment team has carved shallow banks around the ponds to increase desirable weed growth, provide natural purification along the edges, and offer safer wading. The result is a collection of crystal clear pools and beautiful and accessible surroundings. No alterations were made to the natural trout stream running beside Spring Valley Ponds. Though all ponds naturally warm the water by exposure to sun across their surface area, the recent alterations to Spring Valley Ponds resulted in cooler water returning to the existing stream than before, because the pond beds have been redesigned to release water from near the bottom rather than the much warmer surface water. This retains the warmed water within the pools where it's desirable for faster fish growth, but reduces temperature change downstream in Spring Valley Creek. Access has been a major design objective in the redevelopment of Spring Valley Ponds. Natural-looking peninsulas have been created to accommodate wheelchairs and walkers. Very young children, old-timers, and others with temporary or permanent mobility challenges can all enjoy one of America's most rewarding pastimes here. Access was also a consideration when re-establishing the pond beds. Now, shallow undersurface pathways allow wading from shore to islands and out to other landings through surrounding water that's well over 7 feet deep. Fishing season at Spring Valley Ponds will be 365 days a year. In addition to extending the calendar for outdoor fun, the off-season periods are an excellent chance for avid fishermen to try out new lures, equipment, and techniques before it's tournament time. Management of the valuable aquatic resources at Spring Valley Ponds is no small task. It requires dedication, hard work, and a sense of humor can help when it comes to problem solving. What was intended as a little amusement for local bird watchers turned out to be a great solution for the large number of Canadian geese that were landing, leaving pollution and creating green algae-infested water. It turns out that the geese simply don't like the company of this flashy flamingo, and they haven't landed at the pond since the harmless and lonely rascal was first plugged in. Most of the pond management techniques used are a little more conventional and considerably more sophisticated. For example, to release the cooler bottom water back to the natural trout stream and retain the warmer surface water, a large mesh and grate covered intake is set out in the deep area of each pond bed. From there, water is directed to a vertical chamber where it flows over a stack of panels that can be individually installed or removed to establish the desired surface height of the water. Adjusting the surface height allows pond managers to collect floating debris in the adjacent skimmer, then manually remove the accumulation on a routine basis to maintain the water's pristine appearance and healthy condition. Because ultimately, Spring Valley Ponds is about fish, healthy fish that are full of vitality and free of mercury, parasites, and harmful antibiotics. Fish that offer a vigorous fight on the line and a nutritious meal on the plate. Fishing should be fun, a chance to interact with and outsmart native fish. Here, more time will be spent catching and watching fish play the lures rather than just waiting for fish that aren't there. Spring Valley Ponds not only holds lots of fish, but many will make trophy-sized catches that could be proudly mounted and displayed. Of course, large fish are expensive, and just the sight of a 20-pound trout in these crystal-clear waters can bring heart-pounding excitement. So rather than spend several dollars a pound for every fish caught, at Spring Valley Ponds, anglers are encouraged to catch and release. Most fee fishing ponds don't allow that option due to the significant loss rate on released fish. That problem has been overcome here by developing unique fish recovery tanks with a special saltwater solution that helps the fish fully recover from the trauma of the catch before being returned to the ponds when they're fully fit. Plans for the near future of Spring Valley Ponds call for an underground viewing area where guests will walk down ramps between adjacent ponds to get a look at the fish on their level. At least 44 different species, all current or historic residents of southeast Minnesota waters, will be represented in their natural environment. Additional landscaping will include streams and waterfalls that add to the aesthetics and ongoing environmental education demonstrations at the ponds. Revitalizing Spring Valley Ponds is a commitment inspired by the unique potential this southeast Minnesota resource holds as a gateway to outdoor activity for people of all ages and abilities, an interactive environmental learning center, and a haven for renewing relationships with nature.
Plans were to have this kind of what you see there. When we were going to operate this, there are some like this in the country, but this is quite a bit different in quite a few ways. We were looking at 25-foot water clarity was going to be our objective, because I think that's really important. I like looking at fish, I like to see them. So that was one of our goals. Another one was to have a really world-class fishing experience where people could catch fish. You might say have fish on the line more often than not, and make it so that it's real exciting to catch fish. That's what the catch and release is about. You can't afford to catch 10-pound trout and release and keep them because they cost $3-4 a piece. I mean, $3-4 a pound times 10 pounds is a lot of money. You'd spoil your whole afternoon if you caught 10 of those things. We're trying to do it on an environmentally landscaped way so that it looks like nature, and yet it's still got walkways you can walk around in, like in a golf course and parkland. It's a beautiful spot. We're trying to keep that. We actually got a pair of eagles and a pair of osprey down there permanently, I think. Unfortunately, I wish they'd wait until we got it open because they're expensive what they eat. And we were going to put in an underground viewing pond between two of the ponds. I already have one of these in Monticello. You saw a video of a little bit of an underground pool. That's really beautiful when you see the fish swimming in nature, right in between the weeds, just like it's outdoors. It's quite an experience. And we were going to focus a lot on the kids and the family aspect of this. You're going to have kids coming over here for routine school classes, so they could learn about nature and about the fish. I don't think most people even realize what a garter is or a sculpin. We're going to have the kids come here and learn about the park and about the wildlife. And then, of course, they make the parents go. That's how McDonald's school focuses kids. I got two little kids, and I know I eat at McDonald's a whole lot more than I want to because they make me. And we were going to design it for handicapped people because the Mayo Clinic is less than 30 minutes away. And people, when they go to the Mayo Clinic, typically go for 2 or 3 days, and they got most of the time is just waiting. So you can come down here and go fishing. Real computer skills. The current plans, we've kind of backed on that a little bit because we ran into a tremendous amount of resistance. But we still feel very strongly, if we can do the whole thing, we want to do it. But at least we want to continue what we're currently, what it was registered for. I bought a fish hatchery. I didn't buy a piece of land. I bought a fish hatchery, which has been that way for 60 years. And I don't think there's any grounds the state could have to close that. But we still are having trouble with that. We've made a lot of improvements in this thing from what it used to be. When I bought this property, and in fact, historically, it's had a problem with nitrogen supersaturation in the water. The gases in the water kill fish. And it's just nitrogen gas, the kind we breathe every day, but it causes the fish to go through something called the bends or something like that. They get what we call supersaturation of the bloodstream, and their eyes pop out, they get big blisters. It kills fish. And in fact, when we bought it, there were no fish in most of the ponds. The water coming from the spring was killing the fish. And in fact, even in the trout stream itself, where it was dumping into the creek, there were fish with Popeye and bubbles on their skin because they tend to stay right near the spring. And they were being killed by that spring. We got a system, you saw that degassing structure, gets rid of that. We also improved the water so that we're cooling the water more than it used to be. Because we partly wanted to protect the trout stream, but we also wanted to keep warmer water in our ponds so we get better growth rates. Trout do better at 70 degrees than they do at 50 degrees. We put sand around the shoreline so there would be no wave action that puts sediment into the water. And we put in a sediment collection system along the stream where we could collect the water. The sediment, if we drained the ponds down to clean them, we had a way to clean the ponds without any risk of getting sediment in the stream. We've had a lot of trouble with this. We've been going around for a couple of years with the DNR, PCA, on issues down there. And I think partly because of some trout fishermen that are not happy with it. But I think it's partly because of some people in the state. I don't know what it is. I really don't. All I know is we've gone through one heck of a lot of issues. And I'll give you some examples. And all of these, I think, are unique to Spring Valley. We're the first hatchery in the state where they actually charge a fee, a water appropriations fee, on a free-flowing spring that was already there. But then, not only did they charge it, they wouldn't allow us to, on the agricultural rate, which is a $700 or $750 a year, said, no, agriculture is not aquaculture. This is aquaculture, and we're going to pay the commercial rate that you pay for every other, you know, like NSP would pay. Only fish farming is not that lucrative. It really is not a profitable business. I need money out so I can afford to spend money on this thing. But it wasn't in fish farming. I made it in manufacturing.
Mr. Bondas, if you could hold that point there. We do have a quorum. We'll officially call the meeting to order. Representative Hamilton moves the minutes of April 11th, 2006. Any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Hamilton. Okay, with that, so now we are officially in order. We have, I will move that House File 4041 be recommended pass and sent to the Committee on Rules. That's where we're at right now. And members, this is a hearing on 4041 having to do with point number two up there. One and two. But it's going to be a much broader discussion than that for members because my question has been after seeing what Mr. Bondas has been put through, trying to get this open in outside of Spring Valley, Minnesota. I want to look at aquaculture on a statewide basis, and when we get the DNR and MPCA down here, I want to know if I want to start an aquaculture farm tomorrow, could I even do it? So it's going to be broader than 4041 as far as the questions and the comments, and we can see right here some of the situations that Mr. Bondas has run into. And we'll have the ability to question DNR and MPCA when he's done his presentation. So that, I believe you left off on, okay, you were the first hatchery with a water fee on a spring that's already there. You're being charged at commercial rates instead of agricultural fee rates, which 4041 would take care of. Where'd you leave off here? First hatchery ever with a temperature limit. I'll let you take it from there, Mr. Bond.
Well, part of the problem with this agricultural fee even is we can't, unless I buy the whole thing, the state is not willing to allow me to dump my discharge water in, unless I dump it to the creek separate from the water I don't buy. That's an almost impossible engineering problem to do, but they want me to keep the two separate until I dump it into the creek. And it's not totally impossible. It's very expensive. I mean, we're talking $50,000 is what we calculated to do that. But the temperature limit, there's no other hatchery that, at this point, I don't think there's any other hatchery that has a limit imposed on it that you can't go over. We could live with monitoring. They do that, monitoring in the state hatcheries. But they don't have a limit. They have a monitor twice a month, check the temperature, and report what it is. In our case, they ask for more than that, and I'm okay to put, they want to put probes in there so they can measure it on a routine basis and put it in computer. We have no problem with that, but to guarantee that it can't get old under a certain number, that's a problem. A big problem, because the numbers they're using are so small they can't be met. An insistence on a point source permit, we voluntarily gave that at the end, but it wasn't because I wanted to, it was because PCA said, well, it's on a trout stream, you should do it. But there's a lot of trout hatcheries on trout streams. They don't do it. They haven't done one before. First EAW required on an existing hatchery. Environmental assessment worksheet is a real serious issue. In our case, this could, it depends on how the committee decides, it could lead to an environmental impact statement. And obviously we don't want that to happen. And if it to happen, we'd have to close it because those are really, really expensive. And the reality is, I can afford to spend some money on this, but I can't afford that. What I've been told is $500,000 or more. I've already spent $500,000 fighting this, and I'm not even at the point where they talk about expense yet. We were denied a permit on 30 species right from that area, right from the streams in that area that we couldn't have in that pond, for whatever reasons, I don't know. And we were also the first hatchery where the license was pulled. As far as I know, there was no legal issue. They just pulled the hatchery. He said, well, it took a couple of years of stuff. Why has it taken so long? And that's why I was told it was pulled. Now, you think I'm trying to make it go for 2 years? That I just can't understand that. Does the end justify it? I think sometimes in the DNR and DCA, they get into it. Well, we got to close this one. No matter what we do, we're going to make it happen. And this is what's happened. I mentioned I've already spent over $500,000, lots more than that, just in legal fees, engineering fees, changes that have been requested. It's a nightmare. I wouldn't have started this, that's for certain. But after I spent $1 million developing this, I can't afford to just walk away from it. So I'm kind of caught in this. My house is on fire. I have to put it out. I wish I wouldn't have built the house, but it's too late. Another thing that really bothers me is the DNR Waters, Fisheries, and PCA, they all have a separate agenda. They all ask for different things. I try to answer one of them, and then the next one comes up. I try to answer that, and sometimes the third one will come up, and they conflict with the first request. I don't know why Waters is asking for things that have to do with fish, or why PCA is asking for things that have to do with water appropriation, but these things keep being asked.
Representative Heiger, can you have a question?
Yes, I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and
anybody.
I just have a perhaps a comment, but you can respond to it. Listening to your presentation and knowing where you've been with the DNR and the Department of Waters and whatnot all, I think that the answer for you would be perhaps to have something in legislation of where you would come under the guise of Department of Agriculture. So that, I mean, if we could get the aquaculture people, and I know they have made a request in my district to be treated like farmers. And it's perhaps something that Kobe perhaps could comment on if we could get something drawn up. I know that time is short, but it's something that we need to look down in the future of treat these people that truly are farmers as farmers, and you most certainly are. And I think that would address the concerns that you have, and yours is not unique. There's a lot of other people that have similar situations like you in the state of Minnesota that have complained to me over the years with problems very similar to yours.
Representative Heigerk, and that's the point of the hearing today.
Right.
Like I said, it's not just 4041. That's one issue, but you see there's a lot of issues up there. This affects all aquaculture in the state. I think this committee needs to look at what is aquaculture. Do we want it? Do we want to shut them all down like we're trying to do with Mr. Bondas?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, not even let them get going? And we'll hear from the other side that has concerns about what we're doing here, and do we want to hear both sides so we can make some decisions? But your point's very well taken. Representative Hamilton.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, it's pretty ironic because the same issues that gentleman here is having are the same issues that you have when you try to permit a livestock facility, if you will, going through the PCA. We've made pretty good inroads, if you will, as far as information that has been requested, because in the past you'd run in where you have multiple entities there asking for all different information addressing the same item, and you're not getting a consistent request on what it is. I mean, give us something that's consistent and we'll abide by it. But if it's a moving target, that's what makes it difficult. And I think that's challenges that you're running into also. Is that correct?
Absolutely. And I agree that, I know many fishermen would like to be under agriculture. I think they were asked a few years ago. Some of them didn't want to, but they've changed their mind. The ones I've talked to have changed their mind. They want to go back to agriculture. Well, they've never been there. They want to be there.
Okay, Mr. Bondas, do you want to proceed with your presentation? Or Mr. Sternberg, you have something? Or?
No.
Okay, Mr. Bondas.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Another issue that we can't have, that we've had the issues where we've agreed on targets or numbers. The water appropriation thing, I think we've agreed on 4 or 5 times with different people, and then a month later it changes. The temperature issue, it changes. It's gone from monitoring with permanent probes to 58 degrees to 55 degrees. 55 is an impossible number. But it's gone from one to the next to the next. It just keeps, it's a, like you mentioned, a moving target. OSHA, and this is one thing that really irritates me. I could spend hours on this, but I'll just give you a couple of examples. I mentioned at a meeting about 6-8 months ago that I don't know why they're treating me like a criminal. I've had a business for 40 years. And I've had an office in Russia and Japan and Germany and Barbados. All kinds of countries I've dealt with. And I've never had any trouble. It says in the U.S. I've never been fined by a PCA. I've never been fined by OSHA. 2 weeks later, just by coincidence, OSHA came out and audited my plant for 2 full days. They've come out before they even gave us a certificate once for really running a clean place. They came out 2 days. They didn't find one thing, but somebody told them something and really got them stirred up. This idea that you've got to demonize a person to stop them really, really irritates me.
I don't like it either.
I don't get it. I appreciate it, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Pennis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for Mr. Bondas, it seems to me, and I hope you have a paper trail of all this.
I got a lot of it.
Okay, and I think
Representative Pennis, we're just starting with a nicely here.
Okay, and that's critical that the members of the committee see that, because I learned this in teaching school, and I learned it even more in the legislature. You date it, you take the notes, you sign it, and you store it. And it's come in handy, very handy at times. So that's good. I'd like to see that.
I appreciate it.
And the MPCA and the DNR have files that are...
Well, we could get those too.
We can get those too, that's right. Mr. Bondas?
I have nothing to do.
I think that, as I understand, there are 4,000 pages that we've asked for. It's a large file that they have that we're asking for in the Freedom of Information. You're right. We have a pretty good paper trail. A disease certificate I asked for. Sell my fish, you need a stocking. You have to have disease-free certified fish. I asked for that certificate. It normally takes 6 weeks to 2 months to get the certificate. The Fisher checked, they were found to be clean. I didn't get that certificate till 7 or 8 months later.
Mr. Bondas, I'm going to interrupt here. Current law says under 17.491, under the Department of Agriculture, aquaculture is agricultural pursuit, aquaculture, and then it goes down, aquaculture is an agricultural pursuit. 1989, that was put in. So maybe my bill should just go ahead and do that, since the law already says it's an agricultural pursuit. Mr. Gallagher, do you have any comments on that? It's right in the statute right now.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You are correct. The statute does define aquaculture as an agricultural pursuit.
So why would the DNR want to permit this as a commercial pursuit?
I don't have an answer for that.
Oh, that's what we're wondering. Yeah.
I wish if I had the answer, then we might not need that hearing.
Okay.
There are, Mr. Chairman, there are some other references to aquaculture being an agricultural pursuit in the statute, in the various statutes. 41C02 defines farming to include aquaculture. So there are a number of references in the Department of Agriculture's statutes that refer to aquaculture already, but they have very little regulation of the industry other than they're responsible for promoting it, but not for regulating it.
So then why was the DNR and MCCA or whoever going to charge Mr. Bond $7,000 for a permit?
Again, that's under DNR's water appropriation fee, but it does not deal with the fact that this is an agricultural pursuit pursuant to Minnesota statutes.
Well, they'll have their time to. Okay, please continue, Mr. Bondas.
I think it was mentioned, you know, that this has closed down a lot of fish farms. I know some that has happened to it. I left you all a copy of a project where it's closed. $16 million, the company went bankrupt, along $16 million, 30 or 40 jobs up on the Chisholm Iron Range, up at the city of Chisholm. That project was killed by mainly DNR, PCA involvement to routinely kill it. For 6-7 years they did that project. Now, that project had no community support. The community thought maybe they were polluting the water from the city. It might be possible. But in my case, the community is totally, totally behind it. I mean, I must have 95% of the people in that area.
And to that point, committee members, I've received letters of support and resolutions of support from, I believe, the mayor of the city council. I've received letters from county commissioners, township officers, the township association, and so forth. So the community of Spring Valley and the county are, well, the officials are 100% behind us. You can't say every person is, so... please continue. We've got about 5 more minutes, then we're going to go to folks with concerns.
Now, you also include some census data. The state of Minnesota, in that census data you have, $3 million a year is what the total aquaculture business was. The average is $19 million per state, including Arizona and Nevada. I mean, you add them all together, it's $290 million in aquaculture-friendly state of Mississippi. The benefits to the state, and there's a lot of them, this is a very fast-growing sector. It's 15%. It's the fastest-growing worldwide sector of agriculture. The model we were going to do, this recreational fishing model that we were going to promote here, hasn't been done in Minnesota, but I think it's a tremendous concept to really encourage recreation. Stocking it doesn't cost the state a thing, and yet it provides recreation. We were providing, on that stream, there's an average of about 2 people, from what I could see, per day fishing that stream from below our pond. We're going to have 50 or 100 people fishing in the pond. That was our goal. And that's a tremendous improvement. Now, you could say, well, the brown trout are an issue. But the fact is, brown trout are not an environmental issue. They're a recreational issue. They are not native to Minnesota. They're native to Germany. Rainbow trout are not native to that area. They're also an introduced species. So they're introduced for recreation, and we're going to increase the recreational value. And furthermore, we're going to make this something that handicapped people could use, older people could use. My uncle's 85. He can't go fishing in a boat because he said if I step into that boat, he's 85, and I trip, I could drown in a foot of water. I can't take that chance anymore. And kids, we're going to make this something that kids could learn from, bring them down there for educational value. So it's a tremendous value for the state. So all in all, this is a tremendous program. So that's pretty much it. If you want to add a couple things.
Okay, thank you.
Oh, no, I just had one. I forgot. I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. The DNR can't do this thing for a lot of reasons. What city would they start in? Who would pay for the fish that are being caught? What's the value of this for the recreation, for the tourism? What's the value of this kind of thing for the state if we have quite a few of these going on in the state? And which sport has more participants, fishing or football? Look how much money is spent professionally on football. People pay $100 a day to go to a football game. I can see where they pay that for fishing any day. Which state's got the most water in this country, the most resources? This is a potential that could be done in Minnesota, an incredible high numbers if it works. And the other thing for me is, why is the state trying to stop it so hard? I still don't know that. So, okay, now
any questions for members at this point? That's a good stopping point. That's 40 minutes for Mr. Bondas. Now we'll go to, is there anyone that would wish to testify on behalf of House File 4041. Now, is there anyone? We're going to be kind of a little more lenient here as far as people not necessarily being signed up. I'm going to show a little discretion and allow folks that may wish to testify with concerns that aren't on our list the opportunity to do that. Testify with concerns on House File 4041. Okay, my good friend Mr. Broberg, and what was your name again? And back there? Okay, would you all like to come up, all three of you? There's room for three up here. Who are you with? Okay, I think what we'll do is I think we'll have real people first, and then I think we'll go into agencies after that. So we'll, because with the time here, we'll go till about, we'll allow about to 10:02, so we've got the same timing. And then I do want to bring the agencies down to visit with the agencies on this. Now, also, to correct one statement, Mr. Bondas said that he hadn't been fined by OSHA or the MPCA up to the point where he was inspected by OSHA. I don't think you were fined by OSHA, were you?
No, but I have been fined now by OSHA because of this fine, $12,000.
And that's the MPCA.
For starting this thing, I didn't know about the working. There was a rule working close to a trout stream, within 100 feet of a trout stream, and for another rule I didn't know about, which was stormwater construction permit. So I was fined for that. I didn't deliberately do that. I would never have stuck my neck out that way because I know you get on the bad side and it's not a good spot to be.
Well, there are some times when people are fined by state agencies when they didn't do anything wrong. I can tell you all about that. So with that being said, welcome to the committee, gentlemen. Mr. Broberg, I'm going to let you kind of lead the show as far as who goes when and so forth. You've got 40 minutes. You don't have to use it all. I'd also like to introduce a good friend of mine, Larry Hunt, from Fillmore County, from the great city of Fount, who is a retired veteran services officer. I didn't know he retired. So he's here, I think, with Minnesota Trout Association. Okay, Mr. Broberg, the floor is yours, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jeff Broberg. I'm currently the president of the Minnesota Trout Association.
With world headquarters
in Preston, Minnesota.
All right.
Greg's hometown.
Okay.
As an avocation, I'm a trout fisherman. As a vocation, I'm a geologist. I'm a Minnesota licensed professional geologist, and I own and operate an environmental consulting firm out of Rochester. I want to talk to the committee related to the bill and the proposal, but in the context of the importance and fragile nature of our trout stream resources. Many people don't realize what it is that sustains our sport. These are cold water springs that come out of the ground at 48 degrees and run down high gradient valleys in little blue ribbons that sustain trout. We have 90,000 trout fishermen that buy trout stamps every year that rely on these resources. We have a history of in our trout stream watersheds of severe agricultural impacts that were the result of poor land use practices that really got much better starting in the 1980s and 90s. And in the old days, in the 1970s and before, we relied almost totally on stocked fish in our streams. With the restoration of our landscape and the improvements that we've seen in water quality in the last 20 years, we now depend on natural reproduction in the streams that relies on a continuation of this water quality. The water quality is dependent on keeping the water clean and cold. And that's some of the concerns that have brought us here and the issues that we've had with this particular hatchery facility. We have a situation here where the springs that are used for the hatchery constitute half of the flow of Spring Valley Creek. Half of the flow of Spring Valley Creek has been captured by a concrete manifold that he showed in his pictures that was installed without a permit. The ponds were dug out and restored without a permit by a contractor that did all of the excavation work that routinely gets permits and knows that those permits are required. We've had continued operations of this particular hatchery without complete applications so that we cannot determine what the potential impact will be on the stream. Our fear is that the use and warming of this water will have a detrimental impact for nearly the entire 11 miles of Spring Valley. In my business as an environmental consultant, it's the applicant's responsibility to disclose what the plans are and to deal with the state agencies, and admittedly this can be a complicated matter, but it is clear in the rules, it's clear in the law what the process is to go forward, and I think Mr. Kinnick was going to talk about that in some more detail. Our organization has a resolution on the books related to Mr. Bondas' facility that says he needs to get all of his permits. We need assurances from the real people at the DNR and the folks that have the expertise to determine whether there will be an adverse impact. We don't know whether there will be or not, but we believe it requires a full disclosure and a determination, ultimately, that we will not harm the resource, the public resource in Spring Valley Creek. We have other concerns based on observations that we made. When we were invited for an inspection, we found the ponds full of things I term odd fish. A pond full of white rainbow trout. White as a piece of paper. I've never seen anything like that. They're
albino?
Totally white albino fish. Another pond of black rainbow trout. Black as night. You couldn't see them hardly in the water. And another pond of golden rainbow trout. These are apparently races of fish that we don't want to see the risk of escape. We don't want to see big golden trout in our streams where we have natural reproducing populations of fish. The issue of fish escape is a big issue. The issue of potential fish disease is a huge issue. Hatcheries in other parts of the country have been established to be the source of fish diseases that have decimated trout populations in entire watersheds. This is another issue that could be and can be addressed through the permit process. So I think, again, our concern is about the water quality, what we're doing with the fish, and what the ultimate potential is for harm to this ecosystem and the water quality, and it requires a rigorous permit review. I want to talk just for a minute, and I'll turn it over to these guys, about the chairman's potential bill. We believe that in trout stream resources, where we have springs that are sustaining this resource, that it's appropriate to charge fees that are commensurate with the effort that it takes to monitor and assure the health of these watersheds. $750 a year doesn't clearly meet that.
What would?
Something based on the total amount of use, perhaps the schedule of the commercial use that is opposed. I don't know what the proper level is, but there's a lot of work that goes in to the state agencies with processing the permits and monitoring the health of these streams. When we're using a stream that is half of the spring flow, we believe that it's appropriate to charge fees for that commercial use. When we have the potential to degrade the water quality because you're using half of that flow, whether it's for agricultural purposes or commercial purposes, or you even make the distinction, we believe it's appropriate that people pay fees that cover the true and legitimate costs of protecting those resources.
Mr. Broberg, do you have any idea, like when you're driving up 52 up by Cannon Falls, you got all those irrigation pumps going on, and they're paying a maximum of
$750 bucks a year, right?
Mm-hmm. Do they pay that, or is
yes.
it less than that?
Mm-hmm. No, that's the agricultural fee, and
well,
again, the distinction.
Well, $750.
Yeah. I don't know.
May not exceed $750.
Right.
So let's say they're paying $750.
Right.
Who's using more water? Those farms on 52?
The question is whether this is from a groundwater withdrawal or a spring that sustains a trout stream. That shallow groundwater resource around Cannon Falls has nothing to do with the trout streams. I mean, Little Cannon River is a trout stream, but people are not allowed to withdraw water through the appropriations process that would hamper those streams. It's just simply not allowed. They can't draw all the water and take it out away from those natural streams. And that is exactly the condition that we're worried about here. We think that this bill could set a precedent to allow people to capture the use of these springs in other areas for little or nothing.
Mr.
So
Robert,
again,
why do you think that this is being regulated by DNR and MPCA when the law clearly states aquaculture should be under agriculture?
I think it's just like agriculture and permits for discharges from feedlots. That's a PCA issue, not a Department of Agriculture issue.
But that's clearly stated.
The use of chemicals, for instance, is under agriculture. That's true. I think there's a distinction here in my mind between the function of a hatchery and fish rearing and commercial fee for fishing. It's the same as the cervid argument.
So say that again.
There's a distinction between raising fish, say walleyes, for restocking somewhere, and a fee for fishing, which is similar to your cervid issue, where you're raising deer.
Why,
though? And whether or not...
You're using the same water.
You're not using it in the same way.
How are you using it different
for your walleye? For example,
for
minnows or walleyes, you don't need to use all of the spring water, and you don't need cold water to sustain the trout.
You're saying for trout, you got to keep.
And this is exactly the point of why a complete permit application is necessary, to see from the applicant what their exact plans are, just like you would in a feedlot. Where does your runoff go? What's the impact?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Brober, in the state of Minnesota, feedlots cannot have discharge to the waters of the state. There's zero tolerance.
There's zero tolerance. I understand that. And they're still required to have a permit to prove that that's true.
Yeah, that's right. So I just wanted to correct that. The way it was coming across, you're saying that feedlots, when they're permitting, they could have discharged water to the state.
No,
they can't. Zero tolerance.
That is exactly
zero tolerance.
And that may... That is the appropriate standard for aquaculture facilities as well, and it's a more difficult task. This was exactly the issue with the Chisholm ponds 10 years ago, where the fish food, the waste fish food and fish waste was feared to pollute a water supply. And the system they had put together to capture that failed. And it was a failed business venture because they could not show they had zero discharge. I think that's the standard we need to apply. I fished downstream of Minnesota trout hatcheries from the DNR before they put the discharge standards in, and they were a mess. You'd wade into your waist in the muck from the discharge from those, and our state hatcheries now have to clean that material up. we need those standards.
Yeah. Just another question for Mr. Broberg. You talked about having, you said the law is clear on the permitting process.
Yeah.
And I guess my question is it, you know, the testimony that we heard earlier saying that it was a moving target, basically.
Sure.
That was the comment
I made about a moving...
Excuse me.
Mr. Chair, I've had discussions with Mr. Bondas about this over a year ago, and to me, from my perspective as an environmental consultant, it is a clear path. It says that you must make applications for your construction site activities. There was no application made. No stormwater permits resulted in a violation. Before you move fish in, you have to disclose how many fish and what your permit limits are for your discharge. You have to have your hatchery license in place. You have to have your appropriations permit in place. And it would have been prudent for the applicant to get everybody together in the same room and say, how do we work through this permit
process? Mr. Broberg, we have done that many times, and it is a moving target. It's never the same at any meeting. It's never the same. It always changes. It has always changed. I've seen that personally. I can't believe it, and I'm outraged by it. But that's another discussion.
Mr. Chairman, if I can finish my question, you know, my as far as it being a clear process, you talk about make the application. Now, believe me, I agree fully. When we have a system in place that you need to abide by these rules, and the question that I have for you is, is that clear as far as the information that's being requested from the individual requesting the permit? Is it clear? Are all the agencies that are here today are evaluating this? Do they all agree? Do they fully understand and agree with the way the rules are put in place? And is there additional information that is always being asked to where it is a moving target, to where if somebody is asking for this permit, they don't know which way to go because they provide all the information that they think is adequate, then all of a sudden they ask for more and then additional information. And then all of a sudden you talk to one entity and they say, no, this isn't how we determine it. It's determined another way. That's what's frustrating for farmers. We're looking for something that's clear and concise, and if we meet those, we're in, and if we don't, we're out.
Mr. Chair, I understand that, and that's the business that I'm in, is to help people run a clear path through these issues. And it's not at all uncommon for a consultant to make an application and there to be questions about the details or the impact of that. And it's not at all uncommon when your application does not meet the criteria for these agencies to come back and say, no, you got to do this a different way. But it's up to the applicant to propose and the agencies to review. And it does require a clear path, and it needs a clear operational plan. We've heard today and with Mr. Bondas in the past, switching back between a fee for fishing, trophy trout, and rearing walleyes. I mean, I'm not clear about what his exact permit application has been or why those changes have occurred over time. I've not been a party to the actual permit negotiations, but we believe that it is necessary to have a rigorous permit process that is protective of our waters, because he's using half of the flow of a blue ribbon trout stream.
Well, not the stream, it's the
half of the flow of Spring Valley Creek for his commercial purpose.
Okay, Representative Hamilton. Okay, Representative Malt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple questions. The first is, I wonder if you could explain to the committee what warming of the water does to that stream. I mean, I remember when I was a kid fishing in the backwaters of the Mississippi River, we had all kinds of fish. I caught carp and bullhead and dogfish, and seemed to be plenty of fish there. Why would warming up this stream actually
they
cause any problems?
And
then I got a follow-up question. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, that's an excellent question. It's a species requirement for trout to have highly oxygenated water. They need 6 parts per million of oxygen in the water. And below 60 degrees, we have that oxygenation in the water. Above 60 degrees, we start getting oxygen depleted, and trout simply can't survive. The carp, the dogfish, those other species can live down to limits of 1 part per million of oxygen. Trout cannot survive in that habitat. They require the discharge of cold water springs that have those high oxygen levels by the turbidity in the streams themselves.
Representative Moll.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, and then a separate question. Thank you. It seems to me that in Representative David's, Chairman David's point earlier, that when water is used for irrigation, you know, groundwater, it seems to me that that's a different circumstance than surface water that supports fisheries and natural fisheries in Minnesota. Is there a separate law governing those two things or not? It seems that's a little unclear, and shouldn't there be if there isn't? I mean, that
Mr. Chair,
my understanding of this is that spring flow, and it's established in state statute and lawsuits, that spring flow tributary to trout streams are dealt with in the same manner as the trout stream themselves. So if you have a spring welling up out of the bank that flows into the stream, it is regulated in Minnesota as if it were a trout stream. That's different than a groundwater appropriation where you have a well and you're withdrawing water.
Or Sam,
well, and so then if it's a spring that feeds a trout stream, who has the permitting jurisdiction over that as opposed to groundwater for agricultural purposes?
Well, Mr. Broberg?
Mr. Chair, by virtue of the fact that there's a manifold placed over the spring to control that flow and the direction of that flow, it's become essentially a well that is a water appropriations, clearly, and the use of that and the direction through the channels and the pipes and the constructed elements in this spring make it a protected waters issue, number one, under the DNR, number two, a water appropriation issue under the DNR as well.
Representative Moll.
Thank you.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Broberg, I don't have a clear picture in my mind of what a stream looks like if half of its flow is diverted to someplace else. What is the effect on the stream?
Mr. Broberg?
Mr. Chair, the half of the flow is really short-stopping the flow from the spring to be used for this commercial process in those ponds, and then it gets diverted back into the stream. Under a natural condition, prior to any of these hatcheries, it flowed through a small channel directly into the stream. But all of this human intervention and piping has now used and appropriated half of that water.
Does the water that is diverted have the same temperature, quality?
That is,
Mr. Broberg?
Mr. Chair, that's the very question that needs to be answered by the applicant.
And members, just so everyone knows, this is a trout farm that has been in existence since before baseball. I mean,
well, not the 1940s, according to Bondus, but it had not operated since the late 1970s.
But it was a permitted trout farm the whole time.
By virtue of paying the fee, but there were no fish or activities.
Right. So
for activities.
You need to think about that, too, that it's an existing trout. This isn't like something that's never happened there before. This is an existing trout farm. Representative Johnson, then Pennis, then Welty. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One last question. What about other aquatic life in the stream that's having the water diverted from it?
That's a question we need answered as well. I mean, what about the other fish and the invertebrates that sustain the entire ecosystem?
Representative Johnson?
That's it. Thank you.
Now, Mr. Broberg, is this the first hatchery, was that correct, that is being put under constraints of various temperature limits?
I'm not aware that it's the first under the limits. It's not the first that's had to fall under the PCA rules that say that there can be no thermal degradation. That's the rule.
How does one in Peterson operate? How does that do?
They monitor those temperature levels, and my understanding, and it would be best to ask the DNR those questions about what the thermal increase is. They have monitors and records of that.
Do you know what they're permitted for, like 59 degrees, 58?
I don't know that.
Okay, thank you, sir. Representative Pennis and Welty. Representative Pennis?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is for some research people here. This stream is from a spring. It's spring fed. Okay. Then do we have definition
on statute about underground water, because you referred earlier to irrigation, farm irrigation, which is underground water, same as a spring, underground water. Now, when it comes to this...
Can you do irrigation out of a river?
Well, I don't know. We've got plenty of water. I don't irrigate.
Okay.
Anyway, once it comes to the surface, then it's surface water because it's going to go out somewhere. So are there a new set of regulations here? I'm going to screw up farming yet.
Watch it here.
Yeah. So now it becomes surface water and it flows off somewhere. And, you know, it's going to take something with it. So we better check this all out. But a spring is underground. It, by definition, it comes to the surface.
Mr. Sullivan?
Mr. Chair, members, I guess my honest answer is that I know enough about state water law, the five chapters in here that deal with state water law, to know that...
What's your dishonest answer?
Oh, yeah. Is that I don't know. I mean, as the gentleman pointed out, I think a lot of this law, groundwater, surface water, it's all been very complicated. It's evolved over the last, I don't know, 80 years these laws have. So I guess that's the long answer instead of the short answer.
And then I also know that surface water tends to seep back into groundwater. So now we've got a cycle going where we've got laws that change. So it is, in fact, a moving target. This is a cyclic event. In the meantime, you might have a floating leaf with tannic acid in it, too.
Person Wealthy?
Just to that point, Mr. Chairman.
Just a tannic acid leaf?
No, to the surface water. I think Representative Prentice brings up the key issue here, though, is that what is the line between surface water and groundwater? I mean, for groundwater is obviously very important for our agriculture. Surface water, why it might be, but is also very important to our fisheries, which, you know, in our neck of the woods and some Representative Penises too, we care about. Is there a distinction in statute?
Okay, that's the question. Representative Welty, and we will come to you guys after a bit here.
Yeah. I can clarify that question.
Well, I don't want to take away from these guys' time here. Okay, Representative Welty, and then we're going to the other two folks. Are you kind of done, Mr. Robert?
I'm done.
Just
answering questions.
Okay, I don't want to cut you off here at all. Okay, Representative Welty, then we'll go to the other two witnesses.
Chair David, at this time I'll withhold my questions. I just want to make sure that we get through with the other two testifiers and then also hear from the Department of Natural Resources about the issues before I ask my questions. Thanks.
Okay, and then you'll be first on the docket when we do that. Okay, if you could,
I'd like to introduce Kevin Beagler. He's with Minnesota Trout Unlimited.
And how do you spell your last name, sir?
B as in boy, I-E, G as in George, L-E-R. And as referenced, I'm sorry?
Kevin?
Kevin, yes.
I never thought I'd see the day when the Trout Association and Trout Unlimited were sitting at the same table.
Well, neither did we at one point, but that, this has actually been a long evolution that's been occurring over a period of time.
Welcome, committee, sir.
Thank you, sir. As Jeff introduced me, I am the president of the Twin Cities chapter of Trout Unlimited, and I also sit as the legislative representative for the State Council for Trout Unlimited. Trout Unlimited is a national conservation organization that was founded in 1959, and we have been active in conservation and stream work here in the state of Minnesota since 1961. I'm here to represent our membership and like Jeff, the 90-some-odd thousand people that purchased trout stamps in the state of Minnesota. On a personal background, I am a microbiologist by education and training. So we do have some concerns about impacts of hatcheries. There's a lot of what Jeff said that I could mimic. But in addition to that, I have a great deal of sympathy for Mr. Bondas and what he's been through. I was raised in the state of Montana. I've been around trout conservation for over 30 years. I come from a family that's a manufacturing family and also an agricultural family as well. So I understand the frustrations. I've been involved actually out there on a family piece of property putting in two spring ponds with trout. And the one thing I have to say about the process is that, our excavation equipment didn't move until the permits were done. And I think that's probably a key thing about this process, in that it is a frustrating process, but a certain amount of responsibility has to go into the applicant. And again, I understand the frustration over moving target issues and things like that. Mr. Chairman, you spoke about the support in Fillmore County. I want to remind you or refer you back to the January 2005 minutes with the Fillmore County Economic Development Committee meeting, in which it was stated at that time that all the permits, appropriate permits, had been filed. And in my understanding in conversations that that may not necessarily be the case, or at least that's part of the argument on the other side. So I think what the minutes...
Sorry, I think all the permits have been applied for at this point.
At this point, but at that time, the Economic Development Committee and the county people present at that meeting stated that they supported this project based upon that idea, that all permits, necessary permits, had been filed and applied for at that time.
Right. I think that's correct.
Okay, so that's a quick reminder there. As far as Mr. Bond has made a comment regarding brown trout being a non-native species, that is in fact correct, but I think we need to take a look at the historical perspective in the state of Minnesota. The reason that fish was introduced is because unknowing at that time in the 19th century and the early 20th century, our agricultural practices actually were detrimental to our streams. I think if anybody's a student of history or is a fan of history, they can go back and review what occurred in Beaver, Minnesota, in the Whitewater area. So what was required at that time for reclamation and restoration of streams was a species that could then adapt and in fact exist in the streams as they exist now. As they exist now is not what they were like 200 years ago. Concerns about hybridization, and again to review, we saw, this was a great presentation. I will tell you, one time in my life I worked as a professional fly fishing guide. The pods of trout, the large trout that you saw swimming together in a very close contained area, that does not occur in nature. It simply does not. And it is a point source of both contamination and potential for disease. He is correct that you get certification for disease-free fish. Excuse me. That occurs once a year. The other 12 months out of the year, you do have potential for this to occur. Things like viruses, things like bacterial infections, things like parasitic infections cannot simply be stopped when you are dumping effluent straight into the streams. You ask about impact of the stream after the water leaves the hatchery area. Give you an example, there's a precedent for that type of an idea or theory. The state of Colorado, there's a disease in the western states known as whirling disease. We are fortunate enough here in Minnesota that has not come to our state yet. The state of Colorado now acknowledges that the point source of that introduction of that parasitic disease, which now exists in most western fisheries, including the fisheries in Montana, was in fact from a hatchery and from hatchery-stocked fish. So we do have a precedent for being concerned about that. In addition to which, outside of the fee situation, I want you to take careful consideration of the economics in the state of Minnesota with regards to stream fishing. And this comes out of a 2002 report from the DNR. In total, stream anglers have spent between $44.2 and $49.2 million statewide. And I'll skip down to the rest of it, but total sales effects from stream anglers in the state of Minnesota total between $47.4 million and $52.8 million. Total income effects range from $27.9 million to $31.1 million in support of between 822 and 915 jobs, and that's 2002 figures, so that's 4 years ago. So what we have currently as it exists is a very dynamic economy around stream fishing and around developing a natural habitat and self-sustaining fisheries. In addition to which, self-sustaining fisheries are, for the taxpayer, a more economical bang for the buck. They're cheaper to, in fact, maintain and keep viable over the long haul. In other words, kind of an unwritten mission statement for Trout Unlimited is if you look after the streams, the fish will look after themselves. It makes common sense. And if you'll indulge me, I'll just take two more minutes here. I'd like to read a quote. It's two sentences. Members must realize that there are complicated and often unknown ecological processes at work in aquatic systems which may make fish introductions detrimental to the system. Potential problems from such introductions include displacement of native species, spread of disease, and the loss of genetic diversity via hybridization, such as the palomino trout net that we're looking at. What's interesting about this quote is the source that I take it from, which is the North American Native Fisheries Association, which is Mr. Bondas' own organization, and it comes from their code of ethics. I think what we're looking at right now, short of having things like the EAW filed and answering the questions that Jeff is so ably brought up, is that we're looking at an operation that will have potential negative impacts to a stream.
Well, wouldn't any fish farm have potential negative impacts on a stream?
Well, I think that actually depends upon the proximity to the stream itself and how you're handling the intake of the water from the stream, the source of the stream, and your effluent.
Is it
trout? And I think that's the answer that you want to...
Is it trout on... where does Trout Unlimited stand on fish farming in general? I mean, they're pretty much opposed to it?
Well, they're opposed to it from a number of standpoints, one of which is probably the most notable headline would have to be with the reclassification of salmon stocking in the Columbia and Snake River basins. The problem there was including numbers of farm-raised fish with the population numbers estimated for wild fish in an estimation of the river's health, and that's inappropriate.
So incorrect. Would Trout Unlimited just say shut them all down?
I don't think we've ever said that at all. So it's
Or would Trout Unlimited say don't start any new ones?
I can't speak for the organization as a whole. I mean, you're asking me to speak for a national... I'm the president of the local chapter.
Speak for this committee all the time.
Well, I'll speak for the local chapter.
Oh, local chapter. That's right. You're president of the local chapter.
Exactly.
Okay.
You're asking me to speak for a national organization.
No, your local chapter. What would they say?
I think that, again, the impact would have to be looked at as what's the proximity to the stream and what the potential detriment to a stream, an existing stream that has a wild and active population.
What if Mr. Bondas got all his permits? Would you like him then?
I would say that if he got all his permits and an EAW came back and apologized...
Well, why should he do an EAW when nobody in the history of this planet in Minnesota has ever had to do an EAW for a fish farm?
I think there's probably a number of answers to that question, one of which is...
Has an EAW ever been requested on a fish farm before?
Anywhere on the planet?
No, in Minnesota planet.
Okay. You're asking me a question I don't know the answer to.
We'll get that when the departments come down here.
That's fine.
I really feel that Mr. Bondas is being asked to jump through a whole lot of things that nobody else is.
Yeah.
Representative Pennis?
Thank you, Chair. And I really, of course, it's getting to that point where I'm irritated most of the time. But I get irritated when I hear about all the economy and jobs that are brought in from this, from that, from one thing or another. You know, even the devil can cite scripture for his purpose. And I'm saying that because if we want to hear it because it suits us, and I'm guilty of it, then it sounds good. But another group, this how many jobs they do and this how much they spend and so on. Let's try and do what's right, you know. Damn the Bastille and let's go ahead. And nobody should have to jump through hoops. This is not a circus. Well, this is a circus.
Mr. Chairman, just as thank you, as a reminder, the numbers and the figures that I'm quoting are, in fact, state of Minnesota numbers. They're not numbers from the Trout Unlimited of Minnesota. They're from a 126-page document that was an extensive study done by the DNR. And I think the question there isn't whether or not we're unfairly making somebody jump through hoops, but the question is whether or not the facility has been following the process, which there's some disagreement on that, but also whether or not it will have long-term impacts on an existing viable fishery that is part of that economic picture.
Mr. Beeger, where I'm kind of coming from here is what's in the past is in the past. What's been done is done. He's paid his penance. It's very clear that that's been done. My thought is, how do we go into the future so this is done right? Now, when I'm going to start my fish farm outside of Preston, I'm going to hire Mr. Broberg to be my consultant, and he's going to get it done with me. And I'm going to have all the permits. But, we're kind of going back, and I understand that history needs to be known here, but we're going back. What I'm looking at and what I'm going to be asking the agencies is, here we are today. Are the agencies going to stand in the way every step of the way that they've appeared to do to me so far in the meetings I've been involved in? Or are they going to lay out the criteria of what needs to be done and we move forward, and then when he gets his permits properly, you guys are going to be happy?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think that part of the problem there is an interpretation of the process. In other words, one side of the story says that I'm being forced to jump through hoops. The other side of the equation is saying, look, things should not have moved until you had those permits in hand. That's the process in which,
but Mr. Beeger,
if I want to build a deck on the back of my house, I need a permit from the city before I do that.
Yeah. What I'm saying is the point right now, the fines have been issued, everything's been done. They're making him jump through hoops I've never seen before, starting out trying to do it right.
I understand that.
So I'm not saying he did some things wrong. Yeah, he did some things wrong. He's admitted that. That's history. Okay. But what I've seen from where he's trying to do it right, it's just been an abomination. It's been just awful.
Well, and again, another perspective is that do I go ahead and do it anyway, and then you try to undo what I do or stop me?
Oh, that's what we're talking about.
Yeah.
No, well, no, he's done his thing. He's paid his price. Now, from now, trying to do it right in the circles he's being thrown into has just been amazing.
Well, but the assumption that when he went ahead without the permitting was that it was going to be okay anyway.
Well, it wasn't okay.
I understand that. Well, then that's the precedent that we're setting then.
No, we're not. Because he's paid his fine, he's done his thing, he's paid his fine. Now, we're trying to do it right. There's no precedent set there. We're trying to do it right. And the process he's been put through to try and do it right has been disgusting. You know, you're going back saying, well, we're setting precedent. No, we're not, you know, the precedent is he got fined. He did some things wrong. Allegedly. Okay? Now, we're trying to do it right. How do we get it done? Because the way it looks to me, the DNR and the MPCA would never allow an aquaculture farm to be started again. Period. And this is an existing farm.
Well,
so we'll get into that with the agencies. Sir, okay. We've got about 5 minutes left here.
Well, go ahead.
Please introduce yourself for the record and present your testimony. Mr. Beagle, we're done. I'm sorry. Because we're going to have to go into another meeting next week.
That's fine.
Because I want to be very fair to both sides. I won the award for being the most fair to both sides.
And you have been. Thank you for that.
Chairman for the legislature, as awarded by the chairman of the Ag Committee. So,
all due respect, we'll agree to disagree. I understand what you're saying about going back, however, Mr. Chairman. It was under the presumption that it would have been permitted in the first place.
Okay, but that's all gone. Now we're trying to get permitted correctly. Okay, sir, please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman and members, I'm Mark Tenike, representing the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy.
How do you spell your last name?
Tenike, spelled TENEYCK. And I do want to keep my comments...
Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Keep my comments brief and respond to a couple of questions that have been raised and try to frame the question a little bit. But first of all, I like Mr. Bondhus already. I've had a number of conversations with him on the phone, and he's a great guy. This is really not about personalities. All my conversations with Mr. Bondhus would indicate that you can resolve these things in a civilized manner. It's really not about personalities or bashing the agency or bashing agriculture. It's a process, and it can work, and it usually does work. To answer a couple of questions, one, the confusion with permits and moving targets and things going up and down and around and round, an environmental assessment worksheet is really one of the ways to come at that question. An environmental assessment worksheet will give you kind of a roadmap for what the concerns are and where you need to go to get them addressed. We've thought all along that an environmental assessment worksheet was required here, and now we have the Environmental Quality Board saying, yes, indeed, not only is it required under these circumstances, but it's mandatory. And the reason that it's mandatory is not because of the kind of facility it is. The question here isn't whether it's a fish hatchery or a tape manufacturing plant or a utility or a highway. The reason that the environmental assessment worksheet here is mandatory is because of alterations that are being made to the trout stream. The focus isn't on the nature of the business. The focus is on the impact on the resource. And I think that kind of goes to the heart of the question that you raised, Mr. Chairman, and I wouldn't be surprised that we'll have some good discussions with this going forward of whether the Department of Agriculture should really regulate agricultural aquaculture in general and whether this really is aquaculture. But just to put it in perspective and reasonable people...
Sure, what else would it be? If it's not aquaculture, what is it?
Well, I don't believe that a feed-for-fishing operation is aquaculture. I think
why not?
It's just a business commercial activity. It's not currently regulated as aquaculture, is my understanding.
So the other fee-for-fishing places around the state are not aquaculture?
I don't believe so.
Colby? Do you know if other fee-for-service, I mean, if there's other fee-for-service places around, are they aquaculture? Okay, let's look that up. Okay, now with the EEW, do you believe that we need to do an EIS also here?
Well, the purpose of an EAW is to determine whether an EIS will be required.
What would trigger an EIS? What would the EAW say, okay, now
well, the EIS? Mr. Chairman, the EAW answers the question whether there's the potential for significant environmental effects. If the EAW, the EAW is triggered, if there is the potential for significant environmental effects, either because it's mandatory by rule or because there's a petition or an agency decision that it may have the potential for significant effects. You go to the next step, the step of an EIS. If the EAW, the responsible government unit that makes the decision on the EAW, finds that they're not just potential effects, that there will be significant effects.
Do you know the answer to the question, has there ever been an EAW required for any other fish farm, trout pond, aquaculture, fee for service, anything?
I don't know the answer to that, but again, the requirement is not always, but it's often triggered by the impact on the resource. So in this case, it has nothing to do with the nature of the facility.
Aren't there other facilities across the state that have had, Peterson's right on the trout stream there. Aren't there other trout farms or aquaculture farms that are this close to a trout stream in the state?
I really don't know the answer to that, but it wouldn't surprise me if there are.
Then why don't they have to do it?
Well, a facility would be required to do an EAW only if it was doing something that triggered an EAW. So any of those facilities, whether they've had an EAW in the past or not, would certainly be required to do one if they were doing work that would alter a protected trout stream.
So grandfathered aquaculture or trout farms should be okay?
No, if they go out and do, no, Mr. Chairman, if those any of those grandfathered trout streams went out and did work in a trout stream, re-altered, changed the course of a trout stream, they'd be required to do an EAW before
okay,
they did that.
Our time's up, but we've been asking questions, so go ahead for a few more minutes. And
well, the one other point I wanted to make, and I think this will be the ongoing discussion perhaps, is the reason that Department of Agriculture shouldn't regulate here is because the environmental law has been developed to protect the resource. So you have the agencies that have the expertise in protecting the resource as the agencies that require and issue the permits. So Department of Agriculture is an appropriate participant here, and the rules require the Department of Natural Resources. The rules require the Department of Natural Resources to participate because we're trying to protect a trout stream. Department of Agriculture is not set up, nor does it have the expertise to evaluate the impact of a discharge from a fee for fishing operation or an agricultural facility on the resource. That in general, the environmental law, the rules are set up so that the agencies with the expertise are answering the critical questions. And we have critical questions here that the Department of Natural Resources has the expertise to address, not the Department of Agriculture.
So if Mr. Bondas in his enterprise here, Spring Valley Ponds, If the Department of Natural Resources and the MPCA issue them the permits, would any one of your three groups sue the department disagreeing with them? He gets the permits. And you're saying that the DNR is most qualified to do it, the MPCA is most qualified to do it, not Department of Ag. So he gets his permits. Are you going to sue him?
Mr. Chairman,
for the record, you're under oath. You're not under
oath. I'm okay with that. I'll testify under oath.
And the reason I ask the question is because I'm hearing rumblings that if the department does issue these permits, they're scared because they think they're going to get sued.
Well, we have a process. It includes an administrative process and a legal process. A decision of a state agency is appealed to the Court of Appeals, and the test is not whether the agency made the right decision, but whether they made a reasonable decision, one that's supported by some evidence on the record.
So if he goes through all the hoops, gets his permits, you still might sue him?
Well, anyone might sue him. And we have, I don't mean to mislead that you or the committee, we have filed lawsuits over permits that have been issued by state agency. By and large, we have won those lawsuits because the decisions were either not made following law or they weren't supported by reasonable. But
So he can go through the whole process that you folks are saying needs to be done, and you can still nail him.
You can.
I'm feeling misled. Okay. If you could wrap it up, please.
Well, I think what we've seen here is a very good presentation from Mr. Bondus, and the non-government agencies with the expertise on trout streams have identified some concerns. We have a process for Mr. Bondus to make his presentation, for the agencies with the expertise to review those applications. The presumption is that if the permit's warranted, it comes out the other end, that it's a good permit, and we would not sue them. I lost my train of thought. So, I know what I wanted to say. The question was raised at looking through the file, and I would encourage the committee members to look through the file, and I will provide the committee with some of the documents from that file. I think you'll find here that discussions were had between the agency and Mr. Bondus regarding a variety of permits, and work went forward that the agencies and Mr. Bondus did not have the same understanding, perhaps, if the permits required, but I think you'll find the agencies indicating that permits were required and Mr. Bondus going forward without them. It's not just the one that's been resolved, Mr. Chairman. The question on the DNR side really hasn't been resolved, and that's why one of the reasons why there's a cease and desist order. One issue's been resolved, but not all of them.
Well, Mr. Broberg and Mr. Beigler and Mr. Tenite?
Yes.
Tenite, thank you very much for your testimony. I really appreciate it. If you'd just hang around a little bit, there may be some questions. Otherwise, we'll go to agencies. Mr. Representative Welty, was your question to these three fine gentlemen? Or so am I. Okay. Any other questions for members? Thank you very much, gentlemen. Really appreciate your time and your testimony. Okay. Now, if we could get someone representing, is the Department of Ag here at all? You want to come down? I'd like the Department of Ag, somebody from the DNR, and somebody from the MPCA down here.
Mr. Chairman, are you recommending body armor?
They're used to it. For sale. Current statute under agroforestry. What is this? I usually don't read these things, but anyway. Aquaculture means the culture of private aquatic life for consumption or sale. So to me, that'd be fee fishing under the Department of Ag. I just write the laws. I don't understand. Facilities purpose. Can't see the sales up here. I think we got people regulating stuff that aren't supposed to be regulating.
Mm-hmm.
Let me look at me here. Okay. We have, members have some questions, so we've got, if you'd introduce yourselves, please, for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Paul Strandberg from the Minnesota Department of Agriculture.
Okay, Mr. Strandberg. And Department of Ag. And from DNR?
Kent Lockesmull. Division of Waters for DNR, and also if there's other DNR staff here from Ecological Services and Fisheries.
Mr. Loxamo, could you please, Kent Loxamo, could you please spell your last name, please?
Lokkesmoe.
Thank you, sir. And from the MPCA?
My name is Myrna Hallbach, H-A-L-B-A-C-H.
H-A-L-B-A-C-H?
A-C-H.
Okay, thank you. MPCA. Okay, we've had quite an interesting discussion over the last few months with folks from DNR, MPCA. I don't think Department of Ag has been in many of these meetings. But we'll start with questions for members. Representative Welty.
I thought, none of these individuals want to testify at all?
Well, okay, why don't we go through that? That's a good idea. Why don't we have each person at the table here make some opening statements, and we'll open up to questions. And members, we are going to go have another hearing next week on this because we're not going to get through the agencies in 15 minutes. So we'll be looking at Wednesday at 2:30 regular time, room to be announced. So, Mr. Strandberg, please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the Department of Agriculture does not have a horse in this race as far as I can tell. We have not been involved in this issue. We have our primary...
Can you talk a little louder and get the microphone on?
Our primary duties as regards to aquaculture is helping people in their sales. We do not issue permits in situations like this.
Mr. Strandberg, what's your position on House File 4041?
The department has not taken a position either one way or the other.
So you're enthusiastically neutral?
Absolutely.
Okay, I'm with you. Okay, so if we put aquaculture, which is under the Department of Ag right now, for a permitting fee of $750, you're not for it or against it?
We do not have the expertise to do what DNR does at this time, for sure. We are neutral.
Okay. Mr. Lockesmall.
Mr. Chairman, I could give a brief background that might help answer some of the questions that I heard asked earlier. Water appropriation permits are required for the withdrawal use of more than 10,000 gallons a day or 1 million gallons a year. So if somebody hits those thresholds, they need a water appropriation permit, whether it's taken from the ground or from surface waters. The question was asked, when does it change? Basically, when you take groundwater out or water comes out of a spring, once the water is exposed to air, it becomes surface water. And that, you'll find that in the Department of Health because there's different treatment standards for the water if you're doing it for municipal use. Essentially, when it's exposed to air, it would become surface water. The threshold numbers don't change as far as when you need a permit. There are different criteria for under the rules depending on groundwater use versus surface water use. As someone asked, I believe, about a center pivot irrigation system, and that's typically using groundwater. There are some surface water uses. A typical center pivot system uses 43 million gallons of water a year. That, if you look at the fee schedule that's contained in Bill 4041, that's the minimum amount. So they pay $101. Virtually all of the ag irrigation, you would see that on line 1.13. Their quantity is not exceeding 50 million gallons a year. So
how much would the ponds use projected?
Mr. Chairman, that's a number that's been somewhat elusive. If you take the entire spring flow and direct it through the ponds, that would...
But we're not doing that. We're taking about half of it.
Are we taking... Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm not clear on that number. When I looked at that earlier...
I mean, within a few million. I mean,
excuse me?
Within a few million. Are we talking... I mean, I just want to get some context here. Do they use 50 million gallons a year?
Mr. Chairman, definitely.
The ponds would?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, Mr. Bond has paid water appropriations fees in 2003 and 2004. 2003, there was no reported use, so he paid the $101 minimum fee. In 2004, he reported 80 million gallons of use for half a year, and he paid a fee of $240. And that was for 6 months of use. If you just doubled that, which I don't know if that's a fair assumption, but if you doubled that use, it would be $160 million, $160 million gallons of water. That would equate to a fee of $640.
Okay.
If I can just...
Has he got his permit yet for the water fee?
Mr. Chairman, no.
Well, why not?
Well, there have been a number of unanswered questions.
What are they? What are the questions that haven't been answered?
The quantity of water used, whether or not the temperature issues, the issues that we've had within fisheries and within PCA.
Now, the letter came out said it's got to be 55 degrees. Are there any other trout ponds that need to be 55 degrees in the state?
I would have fisheries.
Oh, you're not the fishery guy?
No,
what are you?
Vision of waters. I deal with
waters, but you don't fish. You might fish. Okay. Could we get somebody down to answer that question? Fisheries. Oh, Representative, well, we're getting somebody from fisheries, if they could get up there. Representative Pennis. Yeah, he's still here.
I know. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to Mr. Loxmo, do you know, is he using about half the stream? I mean, that's what we're hearing from some, but is it about half the stream? Is it a third of the stream? Do you know the flow of the stream?
Mr. Loxmo?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Pennis, I do not know those numbers.
Okay.
Who does?
I'm not sure how much Fisheries has looked at that or if Mr. Bondas has done some of those calculations. We have been having discussions, as you know, with Mr. Bondas and his consultant, so we're working through some of those issues.
Mr. Sternberg, you want to come down and answer that? Do you know the answer to that? Or Mr. Bondas? Why don't you come down for the record here, and then we'll go to Representative Welty. What was my question?
Mm-hmm.
Well, no, you had the one about is it half?
Yeah.
Mr. Bondas, first of all, to Representative Pennis's question, do you use about half the water from the stream, or?
Mr. Chairman, the what he was referring to is spring itself flows about 2,000 gallons a minute. The stream before it gets to us, the other stream, the Spring Valley Creek, has probably about the same. I think it's a little bit more, but it might be as low as 2,000 gallons a minute, depending on the how much rainfall and things like that. So I think it's not very far off. At the point where it crosses our property, we almost double the flow of the stream. Now, what we consume in the ponds themselves in 2004, we didn't have a lot of that water. We diverted most of it to the creek because we didn't have fish in most of the ponds. 2005, we had more. But in reality, we have applied for a permit of up to 1,500 gallons a minute of water. We're not using that yet because it's not operational.
So you don't have your permit yet? What else did they want to know? They wanted to know
what they are asking for. Well, we haven't resolved how we can mix the waters together to dump them in the stream. So I think that's the biggest holding point at this point, isn't it, Ken?
Mr. Lacasmo?
Mr. Chairman, it's one of the issues, yes.
What's the other issue?
Well, temperature, Mr. Chairman, temperature has been the primary issue. And
that's
really
why we have fishery
really
guy down
here? Fisheries address that. There are a couple issues I could address relating to aquaculture permits that may help the committee.
Okay, let's hear from fisheries first. I want to know how many aquaculture folks do you regulate in Minnesota? How many farms are there?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and committee members.
The record?
Yeah, my name is Roy Johannes, and I take care of the licensing of aquaculture for the Department of Natural Resources.
How many licenses does the state have?
Currently, we are licensing 166 individual facilities for aquaculture in the state.
For those facilities, what's the temperature requirement for them?
It depends on their standards of where they're at and whether they're licensed near a trout stream or not.
Well, there must be some license near a trout stream. What would the temperature be for those?
The only thing I can give you as a comparison is our state hatcheries, where we're required by EPA standards to be within 3 or 4 degrees of the water upstream of our facilities. That's our best recommendation for an analogy to the situation.
So what's the case in Spring Valley Ponds? Is the 55 degrees within 3 degrees, or is that lower?
That I don't have an answer for you at this time.
Who would? Mr. Bondas?
Mm-hmm.
Come down to the mic here.
Yes, we put temperature probes in the stream last year and monitored it all through the season. At the hottest time, I think the temperature upstream of our stream is something like 78 degrees. We cooled it down about 10 degrees. I it's something like
then
that.
How are you going to make 55 degrees?
That's why I say I consider that an impossible number, but this is something probably is Well, I don't know. I mean, we could answer it here. It's a complicated
thing. We're going to get a lot of answers here in the next.
We would love to be able to have a standard that we don't raise the stream temperature.
Okay, what I'm going to do, we've got 5 minutes. Representative Welty has the floor for the next 5 minutes for his
Thank
questions.
You.
Do you want Mr. Bondas here?
Can I just rapid fire questions, please?
Do you want Mr. Bondas here? Or do you want?
I want Mr. Bondas here, and then also Mr. Lacusmo and Mr. Johannes.
Okay, the and, Department of Ag
and, yeah, I don't have any questions for you.
Mr. Bondas, why don't you join us here? Now, members, my intention that we'll have a meeting next Wednesday at 2:30 on this very issue. We're going to get to the bottom of this. We're going to get this figured out. And it's not just for Spring Valley Ponds. It's the way others are being treated in the state. And can we start any new ones? I think this is could be a potential a boon for agriculture if we do it right. Now, my whole intention, just so everyone in the audience understands, when aquaculture farms are permitted, they're going to be permitted properly. We're not trying to shortcut anything. It's just we got to do it right. Now, I'm going to be bringing up, trying to get some county commissioners from Fillmore County up here. I'm going to get the mayor, city council, EDA director. We're going to have folks up here from Spring Valley that are supporting this thing, and we're going to get to the bottom of it in the next 3 or 4 committee meetings. Representative Welty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I contacted a couple individuals locally to talk about this issue. Actually, I was approached about the issue. So I did some of my own research, but I haven't been able to talk to Mr. Bondas. And so I'm going to just start off with some basic questions because I want to try to get down to the real issue. And first of all, I just want to say that I think aquaculture for the state of Minnesota is important. And I also think it's very important for you to go through the proper permitting process in order to establish an aquaculture farm. But I'm wondering just where the communication breakdown occurred, and then not only that, but we're dealing with an issue that could possibly be, you know, one individual not following the proper procedures. So now it's brought before us as a legislative issue, so now we have to address this as a legislative issue, and I'm trying to figure out if it truly needs new legislation to address this issue, or could it have been taken care of through proper communication? And so I guess my first question is for Mr. Bondhus. Could you please answer, when you, as far as I understand it, you modified the flow of the river or the stream, and you modified it so you took about half of the water away, and then you also established a piping system. Did you or did you not have a permit at that time?
Mr. Bondhus?
Okay, Mr. Chairman and... First, I want to call. I think there's a misconception on when we talk about the half part. The half that they're talking about is the stream. We never touched the water in the stream, never did. The spring that comes out of the water on our grounds, that's the other half. And that's the water they're talking about. Did we move it without a permit? I'm still not sure a permit is required today. There are some people that say because it's a tributary of a trout stream, and this hasn't been resolved, and I don't think anybody's even told me today, we haven't been notified by anybody whether this is a tributary. Even today, I guess they're supposed to notify us or something. I haven't seen anything in writing or even verbally that this is a tributary of the trout stream. So I'm not sure permits required.
It's not on the maps as a tributary.
It's not on the maps. We've never been told, not even verbally from anybody in the state, that this is a tributary.
Representative Welty.
Thank you. I have a couple of questions, I think, to get down to the bottom of this. Mr. Lacusmo or Mr. Johannes, should he have obtained a permit, as far as you know, what he's describing about his location and where the water is coming from? Should he have a permit according to state statute or your rules or regulations?
Mr. Lockhead. And Mr. Chairman, Representative Welty, yes. Whether or not it's a public water doesn't... That's the discussion that Mr. Bondas was just saying about the tributary. And then the chairman said that it's not being on the map. That's not a criteria for a water appropriation permit. Water appropriation permit is needed to appropriate waters of the state. It has nothing to do with public waters. It's groundwater or surface water, could be public waters out of a stream or a lake, but it doesn't have to be. It's waters of the state.
So he needed a permit, correct?
Correct.
So Mr. Bondhus, did you get a permit before you started any of this work?
Mr. Bondas.
Yeah, Mr. Welty, two things I want to say. One is just to answer one thing. When we say appropriate, that means the water flows through our ponds and then we dump it in the creek. We don't keep it, but that's just so you understand. Appropriation doesn't mean we keep it. But answering your question, we paid for a permit, an after-the-fact permit fee, which is double the normal rate, because we supposedly put this structure in the spring. But whether or not that's even illegal, nobody's ever proved. I mean, we paid for the permit, but we've never received the permit.
Mr. Bondas, I broke one of my rules. We're 1 minute over. We're going to resume this next Wednesday at 2:30. I'm going to have the Spring Valley folks up. We're going to work on this for the next four or five meetings.
Two or three.
We're going to get to the bottom. We're going to get this figured out so nobody in this state has to go through what Mr. Bondas has gone through. Okay, with that, good government all the time. We are adjourned.